On this week's 51%, a nurse shares her view from the front lines, hear from a resiliency expert about coping with COVID-19 and what's happening in the face of social distancing.
So people are becoming more innovative and really having deeper connections and interpersonal conversations with one another.
And meet an intuitive songwriter. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Bonnie Weeks is a labor and delivery nurse working at Carteret General Hospital in Morehead City, North Carolina, which at the time this piece was recorded was on semi-lockdown due to coronavirus.
The hospital is currently on a semi-lockdown, so I have two sides about this. I feel like it is very dangerous. I feel like it's getting to be a lot of patients. A lot of people are just coming in because they want to be screened. Some of them are sick, some of them are just scared. So the ER is probably overly filled with people just worried. I feel like that this virus is deadly for the people that do get it. But this is a once in a lifetime for me at the age of 36. And I would probably say a once in a lifetime for most people that I know, where the entire community is shut down.
Engine please. Dr. Peter, how is that located?
So I wanted to become a nurse because I had a grandmother who was very sick when I was younger, and she actually, both of my grandmothers passed away when I was at a younger age, and I had to watch them experience being sickly at a young age, and I just wanted to help people as much as I could. I definitely thought I would live outside of Carteret County. However, this place kind of traps you here. It is amazing. You have the water. Everyone knows everybody, and it's pretty dead in the wintertime, and in the summertime, it probably doubles its capacity of people. I feel like most of the people that come to the hospital are probably the elderly or the sickly, merchant marines or military. They work on the water somewhere, shrimping, scalloping, doing something in the water. I hope that this stop of the world, I will say, stop of the U.S., trying to close schools, close restaurants, will prevent this from spreading and killing many people. I feel like it will teach us maybe what's to come with future viruses, of a way that we can prevent them from spreading so quickly and being so deadly. It just, you know, will show us what to do in the future, like to do this again or to not do this again. I'm worried that maybe after we all come out of seclusion, that maybe the virus will spread then. So do they stop the whole, you know, do they stop everything again, or do they just let you continue living? I don't know.
Sarah Sloan produced this interview from the Working Narrative Studio. Given stay-at-home orders in certain parts of the country because of COVID-19, interviewees may have access only to cell phones, as is the case in this next interview. Dr. Michelle Tugatti's research focuses on the function of positive emotions in the coping process, the mechanisms that promote resilience in the face of stress and adversity, and emotion-related processes associated with health and well-being. She says humans are well-equipped with internal tools, readily available to help us be resilient and overcome the stresses and anxieties caused by the global COVID-19 crisis. Tugatti is a professor in the Department of Psychological Science at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, where she directs the Effective Science Laboratory.
Resilience is the ability to bounce back from stress or adversity. It's the ability to deal with the downturns and challenges of life, even when these events are so catastrophic, they're surprising, they're unexpected, they're overwhelming, everything that we're experiencing right now. So there are, fortunately, some internal tools that we have to to manage that stress. So the research that I do focuses on positive emotions, and particularly the capacity for people to experience positive emotions even in the midst of stress. So feeling experiences like gratitude, love, joy, and interest. These are all effective tools that can actually help us down-regulate from the stress that we're experiencing and help us cope and recover from the everyday stressors that we're experiencing.
Obviously, the stress is enormous, you know, and depending on what one has going in his or her life at the moment, on top of everything else, you know, we have people are living in close quarters, you know, maybe with their partners and children who they're normally not spending this kind of time with. I mean, how do you practice what you just said to really even things out?
That's a great question. I think the first thing to know is that this stress is normal. It's something that is actually to be expected. And the stress that we're experiencing, if you think about it as it's information, it's providing us a tool to mobilize us to activity, to better problem solving. And it's actually drawing our attention to important things. So a number of different strategies that people can use when they're home alone. One of the biggest things that we're all experiencing now is this lack of connection with all of the regulations and restrictions. So we have to be really creative about how we connect with other people. One of our greatest human strengths, actually, is our desire to connect with other people. It helps us feel that those positive emotions like love and connection, compassion. So in a time when we're not able to actually interact physically with other people, to hug, to be close, or to be together in large gatherings, we have to be pretty creative about how we do that. So perhaps using technology in new ways. A lot of my students, for example, are using Zoom right now, or Skype, or Facebook to connect with others. They're having virtual dinners, virtual meals, and they're connecting in a number of different ways. So that's one way to combat the loneliness that people may be experiencing. One thing about positive emotions is that they are fleeting and momentary, and we often don't think of them as having such a powerful effect. But even the smallest and simple gestures can actually have profound outcomes. So being kind to other individuals, bringing someone needed groceries when they're not able to get their own groceries, checking in on your friends and seeing if they're okay. These minor moments, random acts of kindness, actually have profound effects. And it might seem that they're small, but they actually have physical and psychological consequences. So from a physical level and physiological level, positive emotions can help individuals down-regulate blood pressure, heart rate, and they can also increase oxytocin, which is our body's natural ability to want to connect with other individuals. And that has down-regulation effects as well from a physiological perspective. From a psychological perspective, some of the work that I've done in the past looked at responses, positive emotion responses to a national tragedy, like the 9/11 attacks on the United States. And we found that even in the midst of this large-scale natural tragedy, individuals who are able to experience gratitude, love towards their loved ones, these individuals were able to have shortened symptoms of depression, and they also were more optimistic in their ability to cope with future stressors.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask about 9/11 and kind of seg into my next question, just which is my casual observance that I've had over the past couple of days, and that is, this is a threat that people have said you can't see, right? It's a virus, we can't see it. And there's something about being perceived by another person as you could be ill, or you could transmit this disease, like you're contaminated. And so there's this, I encountered this strange situation over the weekend. I was hiking with my partner, and I jumped off the trail because someone was coming into my space, and it was a couple, and I leapt into the woods, and he turned. He said, you know, I'm not dangerous. And I thought, well, that was a very defensive comment to make when you should have been having the same reaction I did in staying out of the space. So I'm just, you know, from a psychological standpoint, you know, it's so different from 9/11 in the sense that, okay, that's terrorism and that's horrendous, but it's not something you can catch.
Yeah. One thing, too, that I think is really important about your question is to recognize that we have a common humanity. So be compassionate towards other individuals. When we're on edge, when we're out in nature, for example, and per your example, that you are worried that other people think either that you have something, you're coughing and you're contaminated and you're going to contaminate others. One way to think about that is to have compassion for yourself. Think about the shared humanity that we all have, that this is hard. This is something that we're all dealing with, and people don't know how to cope. And so forgiving yourself and forgiving others for being on edge can actually be healing for individuals, offering yourself that gentleness to give yourself a break. What we all need right now is to take a breath. And what that does is gives us an opportunity to regroup and reset so that we can be more effective at problem solving and coping and helping on a global level.
Michelle, I wanted to ask you about the social distancing impact. And, you know, I was thinking that I wonder if generationally we feel it differently because, you know, we have one generation or two generations, you know, addicted to their smartphones and whatnot. And this is their form of communication. Whereas perhaps older people, it's not so much. I'm wondering, you know, then is the senior citizen population older? Are they suffering in a different way from lack of connection than the younger generation? That said, that example you were giving of Zoom and you know, connecting classrooms online, you know, my own nephew had a great, he was much preferred that he was able to kind of gather, if you will, online and see his classmates and teacher rather than just download an assignment or something like that. So I think there's this, you know, even though we perceive some generations as being just addicted to a tablet, to a cell phone, there is still this connection in daily life that they're missing, and that has a profound effect.
Yeah, and I think that this potential, people are saying this might be a loneliness pandemic that's also occurring in the midst of this viral pandemic. I think it is instantiated in different ways for different generations, but the feeling of loneliness and social isolation is the same. One way to respond to it may be very different. So the younger generations may be well adept at using Zoom and connecting with others, seeing each other face-to-face using technology, and that's been phenomenal. It's been a great way to actually see each other's facial expressions and respond in a very, as much of a human connection as possible during this time. But other generations are much more adept at other ways of connecting. They may text each other, or they may just pick up the phone and talk to one another. They may go out in nature, and although keeping their safe distance 6 feet apart, they can still see each other and have exercise so that they're accruing the benefits of being out in nature, which is both physical and psychological benefits for individuals as well.
Sure. And then are you observing something so far in this pandemic that is new to you?
What's new with this particular pandemic, I would say, is this our response to social connection. We're seeing now that because we're not able to connect, people are learning about how much more connected they were in the past. They are grateful for the interactions that they did have. And I think what's growing from this is that people are really appreciating how important we are to one another. What's different also is that our natural tendencies to connect with one another is something that we can't do right now. So people are becoming more innovative and really having deeper connections and interpersonal conversations with one another. I think that's one of the beneficial consequences that we're going to see from this pandemic.
So there's another way to cope.
Yeah, one final suggestion I would say is find moments of levity. This can take a huge toll on us to be constantly scrolling and reading about what's going on in the news and learning new statistics every single day. But giving yourself pause, allowing laughter and joy can be one of the most valuable tools that we have for building resilience. So if you can find those moments to share with others and to share with yourself, that would be one way to cope with this adversity.
Dr. Michelle Tugatti is a professor in the Department of Psychological Science at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, where she directs the Affective Science Laboratory. It's where she investigates the science of emotions, coping, and resilience. Congress has passed urgent legislation to ensure that military veterans can continue to attend college. Hundreds of thousands of veterans get federal tuition and housing benefits through the post-9/11 GI Bill. But many received word they could lose their benefits if their colleges moved to online instruction because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Jennifer Brooklyn reports for the American Homefront Project.
Christine Peterson spent 5 years in the Marine Corps and used the GI Bill to get her undergraduate degree at Georgetown University. Now she's a master's student there. She also served as a chapter president for Student Veterans of America. That's how she learned the Department of Veterans Affairs would stop paying some GI Bill benefits for students whose in-person classes transitioned to online.
I first received an email from the VA. The email itself was incredibly ambiguous to me, and I'm someone that has worked in veterans higher education advocacy for 3 to 4 years now.
The VA notice said students can keep receiving benefits only if their school's state approving agency had authorized it to offer online instruction. It's not clear how many programs or institutions that affects. The VA didn't provide a list. But all kinds of colleges and universities around the country have switched from traditional classes to online classes in the past few weeks because of the pandemic. Peterson says the notice from the VA is explicit that keeping tuition and housing allowances unchanged required congressional action.
They're essentially telling student veterans, like, help is on the way, but we can't advocate for or against this help because it's a legislative fix. So I found that really interesting. They are definitely straddling a line here.
In the wake of the VA announcement, the Congress did rapidly pass a bill to allow student veterans to continue receiving their normal allowances, even if their programs remain in distance learning mode. The bipartisan bill moved through the Senate and House with no opposition. Secretary of Veterans Affairs Robert Wilkie had assured student veterans their benefits would not actually be taken away.
They're not going to lose them. No, they're not losing them. They'll still get their benefits.
Lauren Augustine advocated in Washington to make sure the bill passed. She's the Vice President of Government Affairs for Student Veterans of America. She says lawmakers were interested in finding a solution and fast, but with the pandemic, it was all new territory.
These are completely uncharted waters. I don't think that there's ever been a time where we've seen sort of mass movement of universities from in-person classes and business as normal to, you know, upside down world and classes online and canceled and moving out of the dorms with no notice. And for student veterans, this is a really unique issue. And the Hill's paying attention and the VA's paying attention.
Augustine says an immediate fix was needed because a lot of student veterans rely on those GI benefits, not just to pay tuition, but to live and support their families. Christine Peterson says she has some savings, but was worried they wouldn't be enough if her GI Bill payments were halted next term, and she worried about student veterans who support older parents or children.
If my benefits are impacted, we don't have any income coming into our home, and so it's not quite at the scared point yet because we have savings. But I mean, I know for a fact, like, the fact that we have savings already puts us in a very different situation than a lot of my peers. And we also don't have children. So our concerns are honestly quite small compared to a lot of my peers.
Peterson says she knows other populations will be disproportionately affected by this pandemic. She says she feels lucky as a student veteran to be in one group that garners bipartisan support. I'm Jennifer Brooklyn reporting.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Now we meet a gender-fluid singer-songwriter and keyboardist for the Minneapolis band 26 Bats. KFAI's Dixie Trigel produced this audio portrait. Love I normally give away. I'm ashamed of myself today. Go. I'm okay.
Love I normally give away. My name is Bailey, 26 Kogan, 26 Bats. 26 is like my guide number. I see it and I feel at home in my body, which is really nice because I trip out a lot in my little mind vortex. And bats are also a guide or a grounding tool. I love them. I have an affinity for them. I feel like my gender identity is more like a bat. So if anyone wants to call me like a boy or a girl, I'm just like, call me bat. It just feels authentic to me for some reason. So I put those two things together because those are things that I've loved for the longest time. I feel a spiritual connection to both of those things. When I was 19, I started taking jazz piano lessons, which kind of helped me write the songs on Onyx, our 26 Bats album, and it widened my breadth of knowledge for jazz. I feel as though whenever I go to write a song, I need to release something. There's something inside me that I can't really describe in words, so I take it to my piano. And from there, I just let my intuition guide where the song goes, which is why some people just think it's so bonkers how the first part of the song can be different. But that's just like my intuition being like, okay, this is what we need now. Magnified iris kissed inside of your eyelids, sweat out my perception of truth, burnt up the proof that we said in a book. Magnified iris. I wrote that to ground myself and be like, all right, I gotta kind of shake off this negative energy that I'm just taking in. That was the purpose of that song, but I think that song transcended that initial meaning. It took a different shape and it transformed into a sexy, groovy, multi-dimensional song. But usually the fingers go to chords that I like. I start with two chords, then I add three, then I go in a cycle. And then with the cycles of a chord progression, that's when I start scatting out vowel sounds. And then with the vowels, I'm like, oh, that sounds like this word. And then I usually get one line, and then I can find words that match up with the rhyme patterns. I think that's a really fun way to write, but that's not always the case. Seasonally, I think we're in a very, very amazing place for creativity in general, because it's always changing. There isn't just one locked in. Each season is inspiring in its own way. I'm allowing whatever is guiding me to give myself the answers. It is a really like spiritual, beautiful experience, and every time I write a song, if it's a good song, I feel incredible. Like I can float. Magnetized, hopeful dough.
If you're feeling healthy and asymptomatic, there is encouragement and necessity to get outdoors while practicing social distancing, of course, so as not to unknowingly spread or contract COVID-19. The birds might be wondering why their human audience has increased.
This is BirdNote. April is Poetry Month in the U.S., and we're sharing some of our favorite poems about our feathered friends. Poet Emily K. Michael is a birder, but because she's blind, she experiences birds through their songs and their calls. In her poem, Trading Threes, she describes the experience of being out on the front porch with her dog and hearing three northern cardinals singing to each other.
Trading Threes. Step out onto the lawn at dusk, dog leash loose like reins in your fingers. Over the quiet jingle of collar, cardinal voices cross the yard. Crisp patterns of two notes clinking from separate trees, the cardinals stretch the E to oo. A line with two repeats, the near bird calls, gets an answer some way down the street. A second response further away, then back to the first, touch of overlap. Another grabs on to that next line, always in the same key. Nobody speeds up, slows down, backs off, all volume shaded by geography.
You can read more of Emily's poetry in her book, Neoteny. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1602.